Rebuttal. For the record, I'm Oliver Davis representing Mr. Hansen. This is his appeal of several convictions for first-degree assaults and other lesser offenses involving firearms. I'd like to devote equal time this morning to the challenge to his conviction based upon what we argue was evidentiary error in the admission of several dramatized videotapes that were shown to the jury, and second, to the issue of the forfeiture of the firearms that occurred at sentencing. As you know, Mr. Hansen allegedly shot off firearms from his vehicle in the direction of several police buildings and toward pursuing police vehicles. His defense at trial was that he had never had any intent to cause great bodily harm. The jury was not able to decide on attempted murder charges. His argument, of course, as attested to by his extensive police statement, was that he was despondent over his life circumstances and he was hoping to provoke return fire and thereby be killed. The prosecution was allowed to produce and show to the jury a videotaped depiction of an AK-47 rifle's bullets piercing a police ballistic or bulletproof vest that had been mounted on a torso-sized container of water. And the video depicted those bullets piercing the vest, piercing the container of water, and going through the backside of the vest, all resulting in water, which plainly was intended to depict blood, trickling from the holes in the waterproof container. Now, this was demonstration evidence. There seems to be some dispute about that in the briefing, but this was a recreation or a creation of a fictional event. Certainly it couldn't have been conducted in the courtroom for obvious reasons, but this was demonstration evidence, and therefore
as opposed to
testimonial evidence or evidence such as the numerous photographs that were introduced of bullet holes in police vehicle doors and the like. And I emphasize that this was demonstration evidence because it does appear that in that circumstance the evidence is subject to some additional requirements beyond mere relevance. So in Hultenschmidt, the court stated that demonstration evidence must not only be relevant, but it must be substantially similar to something that allegedly occurred in the incident at hand, and it must be helpful to the jury. Something to some degree in the vein of expert testimony. The question, what this videotape depicted, and we're challenging several videotapes, but this was the most harmful and prejudicial. What this videotape depicted was something that didn't happen in this case. There was an officer who was injured in the ankle by a bullet that may have ricocheted off the ground, but no officer was shot in the chest. No officer was shot through their ballistic vest or bulletproof vest.
Well, my understanding is that isn't why the state offered it, to show that it was similar to what actually happened. Rather, they were offering it as to the issue of intent.
The argument was made that showing the power of these bullets was necessary, and the Hultenschmidt court used the word necessary as part of its requirement that the evidence be helpful to the jury. The argument was made that this was necessary to show the power of the bullets that were being used. And that simply doesn't hold water. This Mr. Hansen, and it was undisputed that he was well aware of the power of the firearms and the bullets that he was using.
Was the focus on the nature of the ammunition that he was using, or the nature of the weapon, or some combination thereof? Because I'm trying to remember, weren't they like jacketed bullets?
They were extraordinarily powerful bullets fired from a powerful gun. And the argument was made that the state's specific argument was, we need to show the jury that bullets can cause this sort of harm. Now, first of all, that's something that's within the common understanding of the jury. And in this case, Mr. Hansen specifically stated in his police interview that he understood the power of the bullets that he used. He was a longtime firearms expert. So this evidence simply was not helpful to the jury. It didn't meet the substantial similarity test because it certainly did not represent or even attempt to be a depiction of something that actually happened in the case, but at the same time it was extraordinarily prejudicial and we believe made the difference in a close case where Mr. Hansen had an extraordinarily strong defense.
Why does it have to be substantially similar to something that happened in the case? I mean, you keep coming back to that as if you are demanding that the state recreate the incident when that isn't what they offered it for. Are you saying that you can't use a demonstration like that to prove intent? I mean, in other words, his defense was, I didn't mean to hurt them.
Indeed.
And so the fact that he was very experienced with these firearms and that they can be demonstrated to be powerful enough to go right through a torso or a car door, and that he would have known that, regardless of what he may have said. I mean, the state doesn't have to rely on a defendant's admissions to prove something like that, do they? It seems to me there's a number of cases that say that, you know, the state gets to have its evidence, and Mr. Hansen didn't testify, and his interview had numerous hallmarks of unreliability.
Well, the hallmark of reliability the state relies on is the argument that he was intoxicated during that time, and that also doesn't hold water. Somebody doesn't drunkenly admit to extensive experience with specific firearms and firing them because they're drunk and they make that statement by accident. I think the question really comes down to
whether he made it by accident or not. I mean, the thing is, the state gets to prove that he had the necessary intent when he is denying that he did.
But that evidence has to be judged, though, by the specific requirements for demonstration evidence, which do require substantial similarity. The Hunter case is a particular example of that, in which a firearm trigger device was deemed to be not substantially similar and therefore inadmissible and required reversal. Let me move on to the question of forfeiture. The firearms statute states that the court shall order the firearm returned to the owner upon a showing that the owner had no knowledge of or consented to the act or omission. And in this case, everything required for the state, for the court to be required to return the firearms to the co-owner, Ms. Hansen, was attested to. She testified at trial that this was community property. And she was present in the courtroom at sentencing when this provision was debated. The court erred when it stated, I don't believe she is an owner. That was simply legally wrong. She was a community property owner of this personal property.
She wasn't a party, though, was she?
She wasn't a party, but there was no opportunity for her to be a party. So if you're asking a question about standing, who else but Mr. Hansen would have standing to object to the court's failure to follow this sentencing provision? This sentencing statute obviates the need for a separate action against Mr. Hansen or the court.
Well, maybe it does or maybe it doesn't. You know, I guess the way to test that would be for her to bring an action and see if that happens.
She was given no notice. I mean, the statute doesn't provide for her to be made a party. It simply says the court shall return to the owner upon a showing.
I don't mean to suggest that it would ever be appropriate to make somebody else a party to a criminal case. I'm just saying she's not one.
I'll try to address that, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent, State of Washington, standing in for Andrew Alsdorf today. The only challenge that's been argued to the conviction today has to do with the admissibility of three demonstration videos. And to start with, the appellant's position seems to reflect some great suspicion of demonstrative evidence that does not have any foundation. The Supreme Court said in Finch, the use of demonstrative evidence is encouraged when it accurately illustrates facts thought to be proved. And then they go on to say that it is admissible if the experiment was conducted under substantially similar conditions as the event in issue. Well, here, I mean, I'll talk specifically about the ballistic vest demonstration. The others are discussed in the briefs, but that's the only one that's been raised today. It was carried out using the exact same firearm that the defendant used it, firing the exact same ammunition. and at the same type of ballistic vest that was worn by the officers there. That makes it substantially similar. You know, the fact that, if it be a fact, that no officer was actually shot in his ballistic vest isn't relevant here, because we're talking about the defendant's intent. The defendant says he fired at the officers. But he didn't intend to injure them. And at least one of the officers was fired at when not in any cover. You know, a jury might think, you know, he fired them at the belief they wouldn't be injured because they're protected by their bulletproof vest, as many people think of it. But the fact remains that is no indication of a lack of intent to injury, because this kind of firearm, firing this kind of ammunition can readily penetrate this kind of vest. And in fact, the trial court specifically pointed to that when it ruled the evidence admissible. I'm looking at page 66 of the report of proceeding, and the court remarks, "I don't think a general juror really understands the power of this particular gun that was used in terms of the power of an AK-47. And I do think the video does show that in a way that is different than just describing things in testimony." In fact, there was actually evidence in this case from which a jury might have erroneously concluded that a ballistic vest can stop a steel-tipped bullet fired from an AK-47. That is, Sergeant Maples, the officer who was injured in the ankle, testified that he felt a large impact on his chest right at the time that just before he suffered the ankle injury, which a jury, nothing more about it, might have thought, wow, you know, he was hit in the chest, maybe like the defendant intended, and it didn't go through. He was uninjured. He just got bullet fragments in the ankle. Of course, that would be a completely erroneous conclusion, because these bullets will penetrate a ballistic vest, as this demonstration showed, and very likely what Officer Maples felt in terms of the impact of the chest was bullet fragments, not a direct round. But the jury doesn't know that without expert testimony, and the expert testimony can properly be illustrated with demonstrative evidence. The standard is abuse of discretion. There is no abuse here. And as to, well, the defendant admitted this, well, the defendant said a lot of things in his tape-recorded confession, and I think both parties agreed that what the defendant said in his tape-recorded statement was not 100% accurate. The state taking the position that he had minimized certain details, and the defense taking the position that he had forgotten certain things because of the stress he'd been under and his degree of intoxication. So to say that something was in the tape and therefore it's completely proved and the state has no right to put in further evidence is completely fallacious. This ruling is not an abuse of discretion. I'd like to turn then to the question of forfeiture of the firearms, and I'd like to start by clarifying a point which I don't think is clearly set out in the briefs. The defendant is arguing, among other things, that the magazines and ammunition can't be forfeited because they were separate from the firearms. So what the state actually sought in terms of forfeiture was forfeiture of the magazines that were in the firearms at the time they were seized. They were removed from the firearms and introduced as separate exhibits for obvious safety reasons. The court took the precaution of making sure that the jurors didn't have possession of weapons and ammunition at the same time. But that does not defeat the forfeiture or make them any less of the part of the gun at the time of the act leading to forfeiture.
Weren't there magazines, if that's the right term, that were not attached to the lowers at the time of the incident?
Are you referring to the magazines? Are you referring to the receivers?
Well, I don't know exactly what I'm
referring to. Okay, well.
You just said, I thought I heard you say that the state was only trying to seize those firearms that were actually put together at the time of the incident. And my understanding from the briefs was that there may have been some either uppers or lowers, I don't know which, that were unattached to anything else, thus inoperable at the time they were seized, unless somebody would take an upper and attach it to
it. Yeah, Your Honor is correct. I was referring to the magazines, you know, the things where the ammunition was held. There were also two other items that are in dispute, which were described in the testimony as upper receivers. And basically what you have is you have a gun frame and lower barrel, if you will, that can potentially fire different kinds of ammunition, and you have different things that you can snap onto the top of it
and
to make it suited.
And were you trying to forfeit those?
That's right. There were two of those, which the state also obtained an order of forfeiture. And Your Honor is correct that those particular items were not attached to the weapons at the time of the they were seized. So
what is your position with respect to those two items?
My position is that, you know, a gun does not become any less of a gun simply because it is taken apart. And this court has recognized in other contexts, you know, with regard to firearm enhancements, that a gun can be made operable within a short period of time is nonetheless a gun. And, you know, the record shows, and the case we've submitted shows, that these kind of things that with this kind of weapon, you can dismount one receiver and mount another one within the span of a minute or less. You know, so, you know, these are not merely gun parts. This isn't a receiver sitting on a shelf somewhere separated from its weapon. This is basically a multi-caliber weapon with all the pieces at hand ready to make it capable of firing different calibers of ammunition. So the receivers as well were forfeitable along with the magazines, which were physically part of the guns, and the guns themselves. The issue that's been argued today has to do with the asserted property rights of Ms. Hansen, and the short answer is Mr. Davis does not represent Ms. Hansen. Ms. Hansen did not file a notice of appeal and apparently has taken no action to assert her rights. The statute, in fact, does contemplate how an innocent owner can assert her rights, which is by motion for return of property. It says the property can be returned by the owner. The criminal rules, of course, allow a person who has had property seized to file a motion for return of it. That would be the appropriate way. I'm not going to say it's the only appropriate way, but it is an appropriate way that she could have asserted her rights, and she did not do so. In any event, Mr. Davis doesn't represent her. Her interests are not at issue here as to the defendant. His weapons and his interests were properly forfeited by this court's order. I would ask that the judgment and sentence and the forfeiture order be affirmed.
The upper receivers, as I understand it, an upper receiver and a lower receiver are the two component parts of a rifle. Those two items make a rifle. Mr. Hansen used a firearm, an AK-47, that consisted of a lower receiver and attached to it an upper receiver. There were two additional upper receivers in the truck. They were ordered to be forfeited, but forfeiture under 941098 only applies to firearms, and the definition of firearm applies to this statute. A firearm is a device from which a projectile may be fired, and you cannot fire a projectile from a lone upper receiver. This is not a case in which a defendant is being given an enhancement or having a firearm forfeited. And the issue is, well, it was the upper receiver and the lower receiver, and they weren't put together. We know from the case law that when a firearm can be quickly assembled into its component parts, it is a firearm. This would be like giving somebody 20 enhancements for having one firearm with 20 separate trigger attachments that could alternatively be attached. The device must be a firearm to be forfeited, and these were not. And I make that same argument regarding the ammunition. Thank you.